gotta get my final test put together.
Where is everybody?
Well, they heard you weren't teaching again today, so. Well, how's everybody doing today?
Great.
Good, yeah. I'm ready for maybe some little sunshine today. Mm-hmm. It's been kind of dreary for a week, but at least it hasn't been cold yet, so not really. We've got that going for us. Today is the 1 year anniversary of the tornadoes. Mm-hmm. Hard to believe that as well, but here it is. But hopefully won't have any more of that this year or for a long time. Anyway, it's good. Glad you're here. Glad we're here. We're going to continue our study of 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, preserving a people as we work our way through the study here of God preserving a nation through whom he was going to bring the Savior, Jesus the Christ. So before we get into the study of the text, we're going to ask Dave if you will do some prayer, please.
Our Heavenly Father, thank you for letting us all be able to be here this morning. Thank you for our health and for all the blessings that you give to us, for clothes and food and vehicles and houses and just all the things we take for granted. We thank you for the teachers who are willing to teach the classes this morning and help them remember the things that they've studied. Help us all to pay attention and help the classes and hopefully learn something from the classes. Please be with the ones who are sick, so many still who are dealing with sickness, and help them to regain their health at your will. Help us to always strive to live our lives the way you want us to. We ask you to forgive us for our sins. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen.
It is good to be here. All right. Well, we are continuing, as I said, 1 and 2 Kings, preserving the people. How many of you remember the discussion a while back about the four kinds of parents? The four kinds of parents? Any of you remember that? Anybody remember what those four kinds were? All right, well, we're going to work our way through it here for a moment. Oh, hi. Okay, I have a question. Can I embarrass you a little bit?
Oh, no. Okay, bye.
Just in a second.
Oh, in this?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. All right, good. All right. So we got four kinds of parents. I did not know you were going to be here. I'm glad you're here.
Good to see you.
It is indeed good to see you. All right, so the four kinds are we talking about ungodly, and I've added a little bit to it to expand on it a little bit. Ungodly, that means they're religiously agnostic or antagonistic. They either don't care about religion at all, or they are opposed to it and will fight against it. And in the context of parenting, we talked about that. How many of those children are likely to grow up and become Christians and believers in God? Not many. There will be exceptions, but not because of their parents, but despite their parents. All right? And so that's going to happen. That's the first category. Second category would be the unserious. I said the unserious. They're religious, but not focused. They're religious. They'll go to church. They'll worship God. Oh, I believe in God. Well, you haven't been to church since last Christmas. Well, but I believe in God. You know, I worship, and it's baby Jesus time. You got to go to church, you know, that kind of stuff. How many of their children are likely to be faithful Christians? Not many. All right. Some will. More likely than the ones that are the ungodly parents. Second kind is the unaware. I changed it. I said unserious before, but I changed it to unaware. They're religious, but church focused. What did I mean to say about that? When you think of that concept, what do you think about?
They go to church, but after church, they don't really focus on God very much.
Okay, it's a good way of saying it. Exactly, Mallory, because they're not going to miss church. They're going to be at church. They're going to be in worship. They're going to gather with the brethren. But when they go home and at work the rest of the week, they're not really all that intent on serving God, and particularly in making it a part of everyday life at home with their children. That's just not something that's... They think that, well, you know, if I give my children, I take them to church, they know I serve God, they know going to church is good, important, and that serving God is important, but it's not discussed a great deal outside of the church assembly situation. They think that's going to be enough. How many of those are likely to become faithful Christians of their children? A greater percentage than the first and the second, but not really many. And I put my parents' generation in that category. My parents were like that. They were godly people. They went to church. You did not miss church. But as far as sitting around talking about the Bible at night, you know, some, but it's not a whole lot. It wasn't a big focus of everyday life. And out of the 100 or so kids that I grew up with, 5 are faithful Christians today. Because they were unaware of just how bad the world was around them and what us who grew up in the 60s and 70s were going through. They didn't realize that how the world was seeking to consume them and how it did consume them. And there are a lot of people that are like that today, still the same. In fact, I'll throw Curtis under the bus here, because he came and held a meeting for us in, Curtis Pope, by the way, came and held a meeting for us in Orlando before he was here. This was even before he was in Kentucky. And we were sitting, I took him out to dinner, my wife and I went out to dinner with him, and we were talking about how well things were going at Palm Springs Drive where we were, and how successful that we had been over the years of converting young people and letting them grow up to become Christians as adults. And I said, and I just kind of falsely assumed that was going on everywhere. I was unaware of just the fact, and he said, oh no. Where he was preaching, I think, in Kleinwood, Texas at the time, he said, it's a 60-70% fall away. Because apparently there's still a lot of unaware. And when Chris Emerson was here for the gospel meeting, we talked, one that just happened to have a conversation about my hometown, which is where he lives and preaches now, at the congregation where I grew up. And he was talking about, he was asking about what happened to my generation. And we were discussing why that happened there in Lindale. And in the process, there were some ideas he had. And I told him, basically, this is one. Unaware. They had no idea. And he said, they have the same problem today. Their problem today is more kind of almost like the unserious. It's a combination of the unserious, because there are people that if their children are in a softball tournament or a baseball tournament or a golf tournament or some other event, whatever event, that always took precedence over worshiping God. Now, yeah, church is important. Serving God's important. But, we got a tournament this weekend or a band concert or whatever. We're going to do that first. And their children are growing up to be as unconcerned about serving God as they were. Now, the fourth kind, and this is where I'm going to throw Julia under the bus here. Sorry, I had to call you Jessica, then Joanna, and then get your name Julia under the bus here. The fourth kind is unrelenting, religiously God-focused. These are the people that take it home with them, and they talk to their kids about it. They take Deuteronomy 6, talk to your children about it at home, and so forth, as serious, important business. Karen and I moved to Orlando in 1996. Right after us, Julia and you were 97?
Yeah. You were there before us.
No, right after us. Y'all came right after us. Y'all were there in the next year, very quickly thereafter. And her and Jeff showed up, and Jessica and Joanna were little kids. They grew up with our children. And I have to give them credit, so I'm throwing them under the bus. Giving you credit, because you and Jeff came in, and you pushed on the importance of us parents outside church activity. Even though it's connected to the church, it's not a function of the church itself. Just like the college thing that y'all did, it's not a function of the church. It's outside the church activity, but it's something that Christians that are part of the church do, of getting our children together. And they were, I think you were the prime drivers of that. And don't correct me unless I'm going to take credit for it. But I'm pretty sure that was the case. That y'all came in and y'all pushed this, and there were a whole bunch of us parents, they're about the same age, with kids the same age, got involved in that. And I would say 70-80% of those children grew up and are faithful Christians today as adults. One of them sitting right there, embarrassing her too. That's the great kind. But I say 70-80% because even if you've got great parents that are involved, children are individuals. They are free will. They have free will, and they will choose for themselves whether or not they're going to serve God. And so even that was not 100% successful. You just can't guarantee what your children are going to do any more than your children can guarantee what their parents are going to do or your grandchildren will do. So this is important, and the reason this is important is for this class is because we get to this question. Which one was Jotham? Which one was Jotham? Because you had Uzziah, who was a good king, except for one point where he went, lost his mind for a little while and paid a heavy price for it. And then Jotham, who was a godly king as well. Look in 2 Chronicles chapter 28. 2 Chronicles chapter 27 verses 1 through 9. I want to read the whole text here because it's a lot of material to cover today. But Jotham was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. Verse 2, he did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Uzziah had done. However, he did not enter the temple of the Lord. That was in reference to what his father Uzziah had done. And then verses 3 and 4, he's very successful in rebuilding the city. Verse 5, he's successful at war. And then verse 6, it says, so Jotham became mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord his God. All right, so you have that. And then verse 7, just all of a sudden, now it's the end of his reign. He did all this. They're written about in the books of the kings of Judah. And he reigned 16 years. And verse 9, he slept with his fathers. All right? So you have his life covered very quickly. Then verse 1 of chapter 28. Ahaz, this is Jotham's son. So Jotham at least was very religious and maybe temple-focused, or was unrelenting and religiously God-focused. I think he's number 4 myself, but anyway. So he does that. And then verse 1, Ahaz was 20, of chapter 28. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do right in the sight of the Lord as David his father done. So they're reaching all the way back to the head of the family of David. But he did not do right. So we wonder, how did this happen? In 2 Kings chapter 15, verses 32 through chapter 16, verse 2, kind of says the exact same thing. We won't go back and read this. Very similar wording. How did this happen? How did you go from Jotham, who it is said became mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord his God, to Ahaz at a very young age, 20, did not do right in the sight of the Lord? Shows you what we said earlier. Children are autonomous human beings. They're going to make their own choices, their own decisions. We can try to influence them, we can try to shape them, but they will make their own decisions. We cannot control them. And so even though we don't really know, it's important to keep trying, right? And that's kind of the only point I want to take back out of it. Well, one of the two points I want to take from that is that you keep trying no matter what. You be the unrelenting parent no matter how the child turns out. And no matter how good you might be, your child is going to make up their own mind. All right? Well, let's talk about, and we have that example here in Ahaz as he goes forward in rebelling against God at a very young age. At a very young age, he's 20 years old. And this, again, this is the chart showing, and you have here the halo showing Jotham is a good king, and the halo showing Hezekiah is a good king, and Ahaz is not. And this, again, shows you the difficulty of trying to pinpoint how long they reigned. And it really doesn't indicate that somehow or another in there, it seems like Jotham is deposed, perhaps, by Ahaz, even though he lives to 731, because the events involving during the days of Pekah, or this period of time here, this guy is going to come up here in relationship to Ahaz. He's referenced in 2 Kings as during the days of Jotham, Pekah, and Rezin began to come up against Jerusalem, but it really, during the days of Jotham, but it really takes off in the days of Ahaz. And so there's some overlap there in their time frame. And so we're talking about that. Oh, I found a picture of him, by the way. I was looking online, I found this picture of Ahaz. Yeah, because you think about it. I mean, this guy, no matter how hard he tries to be good, he's just bad. He's just a bad guy. And so that's Ahaz for you. Any thoughts, questions, comments? All right, y'all are quiet this morning. All right. So, Ahaz did not follow Uzziah and Jotham. As we see here in 2 Kings 15, 3, Uzziah was a good king. And verse 34, Jotham is a good king. 2 Chronicles 27. 2 Chronicles 27, and we're not going to turn there and read that passage, but well, except you're there if you want. But in verse 2, there was one little statement there when it talked about how things were good during how Jotham was good. But what about the people?
They're still corrupt.
The people were still corrupt. And so this shows you that even the best parents can be overwhelmed by a society, a corrupt society, that's going to shape their children and have more of an impact on them than they do as parents. All right, so he rejected that. He turned wholly to God, or turned against God, like the people around him. So what we're going to do for the rest of our class is kind of talk about what I don't really like this, the way I've called this, and if you have better suggestions, I'll be happy to hear those. But I call it the five steps of idolatry, or the five stages of idolatry, or basically of falling away, completely falling away. And the first one is restoration of idolatry. Turn, if you will, back to 2 Kings. Let's look over in 2 Kings, and we'll read that text in verses 3 and 4, talking about Ahaz. In fact, we'll just have somebody read that instead of me. 2 Kings 16, verses 3, chapter 16, verses 3 and 4.
But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree.
And then you turn over, if you will, to 2 Chronicles. Keep a marker there, because you're going to be flipping back and forth. 2 Chronicles 28. 28 gives you an even greater detail of that, or very similar to it. But it tells us something even more specific in verses 3 and 4. So I'm going to read that. 2 Chronicles 28, verses 3 and 4.
And he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burned his sons as an offering according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree.
Right. So this guy went all in. And that part there about the valley of Hinnom, child sacrifice. All right, so that, just to remember, Captain, we're talking about Loki there. So he's offering child sacrifice to the god Molech in the Valley of Hinnom. I'll show you a chart of where that would be in a little bit, but or a map of that. But he's offering child sacrifice. I mean, can we think of anything more horrific than offering your children up in sacrifice?
It's abortion.
Well, abortion, that's a different discussion, but it's the same thing. I mean, so we're no better as a culture, as a whole. All right, not any less corrupt. But this is what they were doing. This was a frequent practice. And they would have an idol, a bronze sculpture, just like that, head of a body of a man and the head of a bull, and they would get it on. They would have a fire inside of it, and it would get heated up, and they would throw their children in there as sacrifice. Oftentimes the firstborn would be offered there as a sacrifice to the god. And it's the idea that god, this god will bless them with much greater proclivity. They'll have so many more children. All right. Then they sacrifice in the high places. What was one of the problems even with the good kings that they couldn't get rid of?
Get rid of the high places.
The high places. So how did Ahaz deal with that?
He endorsed it.
He endorsed it and joined in with it. He went in, got all in with it. And then he filled Jerusalem. Look at Isaiah. I want you to turn over to Isaiah, because I told you that you would be benefited by reading Isaiah. If you didn't read the whole thing, maybe you read chapter 7 and 8. But in chapter 7, all right, let me go back to chapter 2. Just give me an idea of what's going on in the nation. Isaiah is writing during this time frame. He's writing during the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, but also even Uzziah. But he's writing during this time frame. And so he gets in there, chapter 2. And in chapter 2, verse 6, we read, "For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike bargains with the children of Israel, Could none of verse 8, their land has also been filled with idols. They worship the work of their hands, that which their fingers have made. And again in verse 20, he says, in that day men will cast away to the moles and the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold which they made for themselves to worship. So he's discussing why judgment is going to come. It's because they were doing these things. Then jump over to chapter 8 and verse 19. It says in verse 8, when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter. And then he says, should not people consult their God? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? And so these are the practices that he has filled this nation with. This is what Ahaz has done. So he has returned to idolatry, what his grandfather and his father fought to eliminate and to get rid of. He's brought it back in and doubled down on it. Tripled down on it, however you want to describe it. Any thoughts or questions about that? Right. I said I was going to show you a man. Let me show you something here. This is an artist drawing, wasn't a Molin Mills picture. It's an artist drawing of Jerusalem, probably prior to the time David would have captured it, or what it would have looked like after he captured it. And you hear, this right here is the Kidron Valley. So you see the Kidron Valley right there. And you see how much sharper that cliff is there. Over the years, after successive invasions, that's been filled in a lot, but it's still there, as I'll show you in just a moment. Just not quite as sharp a contrast. Down here, you really can't see it, is the Valley of Hinnom. I'll show you it in a moment. And this is the central valley. So you've got the city here. This is the city of David. David's going to build his palace up here. And up here is the Temple Mount. I'll show you in just a moment. But this is kind of a central valley. Then there's some highlands over here. And the Valley of Hinnom runs along here on the other side of that. All right. This is also known as the Tyropian Valley. Do you ever see a phrase or hear Tyropian Valley? That's this valley right here. All right. So that gives you an idea of how the state and the city would have looked under the days of David, and all the way really kind of to the time of Ahaz, even though obviously it has spread out quite a bit. So then you go here, and this gives you another picture of it. So you've got this is the valley down here, the Kidron Valley down here on the west side. Mount of Olives is up here. You got that central valley again over here. This is the Temple Mount up here. So it's a little higher up to the Temple Mount. And you see this has the Palace of David. This is a spring, a very important spring there that's protected by walls. And so they would build up these walls, and they constantly talk about building up the wall to protect this from invaders that were coming in. Right? And so again, down here is the Valley of Hinnom, where the altar to Molech would be built. Right? And then this is a map. This is a little more difficult to see, but here's that same valley here, the Kidron Valley. This is that central valley, or as it says here, Tyropian Valley. This is the city of David, and here's the temple up here. Over here on that western slope, hillside, is a bigger city, expansion of the city. Here's the Valley of Hinnom down here. And it's down in here is where they would have set up those idols, especially to worship Molech. So they'd come out of the city, go back here, they'd come out of the city, and they'd go down here and burn their children. And then there's this. This is a modern picture from 2017. All right? So this here, that's the Temple Mount there. This would be the old city of David, the original city there. What's this valley right here? Kidron. That's the Kidron Valley. And then somewhere down in here, the Valley of Hinnom would be. So right in here, somebody's living on a place or has a business on the place where the Molech statue was set up. Down in here. And then the central valley kind of goes up to here, but see how it's been filled in over time. It's been almost filled in there. So from the right angle, you can see that there's still a little bit of a depression in here. And there's that old city, the new city over here on the west bank, on the west side of that. And then over here is another valley comes in, and the Valley of Hinnom circles around all down through here. All right? So, thoughts, comments on that? Does it help kind of getting a visualization? Let me speak English.
Visualization.
Thank you. Of this layout. I tend to not do this a lot because it kind of just glazes over after a while, but I think it's helpful to see. And anybody know what that is?
Mount of Olives.
Mount of Olives, all right. And then over here is called the Mount of Abomination. There were other things would be taking place over here as well, but this is Mount Olives. All right, thoughts, comments?
You know, they did a lot of excavation and research before they built anything over there. Have they ever talked about finding any bones and things? Where that was at?
Oh, I'm sure they have. I don't know. Because remember, it was invaded by the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. It was invaded by the Assyrians, who ended up not being able to take it. It was invaded by the Babylonians. In fact, it was invaded by nation after nation after nation. But the Babylonians came in 586 and kind of just destroyed it. And they would have filled in a lot in building up ramps to go in and take the city. And then, again, also under the Romans in 70 AD.
Well, after their return, and they turned that area into a garbage dump.
Yeah. Yeah.
After their return to captivity, so.
Yeah. So, yeah. And you'll get to talk about that on Wednesday. Yes?
I'm just curious, do you know how many miles it was across? And I'm trying to understand how long it would take to walk across all Jerusalem. Is there any way to know?
It wasn't, if you go back to this, it wasn't that big. And you figure Jesus, you have the concept of a Sabbath day journey. So a Sabbath day journey is like something like a quarter of a mile, a little less than half a mile. I'm just doing that quick off the top of my head. And Mount of Olives is about, so the Mount of Olives is no more than a Sabbath day journey. So it's not a big area. And you can see how condensed and packed in it is.
I guess I'm just surprised. I've always imagined it like a lot bigger. But yeah, it doesn't seem that big.
It isn't until you remember, what are you doing?
Right, you're walking everywhere.
You're walking, and what are you doing when you're walking?
Yeah, that's true.
You're climbing up and down. So you go back to this picture here, you see how the roads are having to, you know, if you've ever hiked a mountain or a hillside, and you've got the trails going back and forth, working their way up. Anybody seen the picture of some road somewhere in some other country where it's like that, it's just switchbacks, and you look, stand up, and they get the picture, and you see the angle down there, and you're like, who in the world would drive up that? But, you know, that helped. So it's not really that far, except A, you're walking, and B, it's a lot of uphill, up and downhill. So every morning when Jesus was, the week that Jesus was there before he died, every morning he would go up to Mount Olives. He would go down the Mount of Olives, cross the Kidron Valley, and then go up into the temple. And then in the afternoon, he'd go back down and across and back up. Or, you know, somewhere around in here, the Garden of Gethsemane is somewhere in there. So that night he didn't go all the way back up to the top of Mount Olives. But when they took him back to Jerusalem, they had to drag him back up the hill. Except it's like, I live within walking distance of Eastside Church Building. I've never walked there because it's still a distance. The key phrase, like you said earlier, the key phrase is distance. All right. Anyway, thoughts, comments, anybody else? Good thoughts. All right. So as we continue now, let's go on to the next thing. The rejection of Yahweh. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 7. And you might say, and this line was saying that I'm not sure how I like the title that I've given this of seven steps or seven stages, because you could argue that these are kind of out of order. But it seems like that there was an effort to restore idolatry, but the complete rejection of God did not really happen immediately. But and it's kind of one of those things where it's like, which came first, chicken or the egg kind of argument. When in Isaiah chapter 7, he's talking about this warfare that's going to be taking place between the nation of Assyria or Aram and Israel against Judah. And I want to read verse 3, but let's go to verses 1 and 2. Verse 3 says, "Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out now to meet Ahaz, you and your son Shear-Jashub, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the Fuller's Field," so it's up there on that north end of the city, "and say to him, take care and be calm. Have no fear. And do not be faint-hearted because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah." By the way, I found pictures of them as well. There's resin and pica. So that's, you know, they're coming up against him. They're coming to attack. All right. Verse 5, because Aaron with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah has planned evil against you, saying, "Let us go up against Judah and terrorize it, and make for ourselves a breach in its walls, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Aram is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And now within another 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered, so that it is no longer a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria. And the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you will not believe, you surely shall not last." All right, so he's saying, don't be afraid of these guys. Trust God. They're going to go. They're going to disappear. In fact, there's a debate about that 65 years. Is it something that was added to the text by some later scribe to explain something? Or regardless, they're going to be gone within a few years. Remember the chart. They're going to die in about 2 or 3 years. So they're not going to last very long as far as this effort to control and defeat them, and they're not going to succeed. And if I go back to verse 1 of chapter 7, "And that came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up against Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it." And so they're coming up. He knows they're coming up. In fact, let's read verse 2. "When it was reported to the house of David, saying, the Arameans have camped on Ephraim, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind." They were shaking like a leaf on a tree. The knees were going, the heart was just pumping because they were scared to death. And that's why, and so God sent Isaiah and said, don't be afraid of these guys. Don't be afraid. So he sent them in. I sent them in to do that. And this is, of course, where we have the passage where he makes the promise. Verse 10, "The Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Make it deep as Sheol or as high as heaven." Imagine that. God through Isaiah is telling Ahaz, ask for a sign. It can be down to the bottom of the undead, bring somebody back from the dead. Or it can be bring somebody down from heaven. Bring Elijah back from heaven. Whatever. Ask anything, and I will give it to you. But what does Ahaz say, verse 12?
I will not ask.
I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Now, is he doing that out of piety or out of a rejection of God? He's doing it out of rejection of God. He does not trust. He doesn't. What he's saying is, I don't care what God has to say. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to find a way to get out of this. And he does try something that doesn't work. All right. So he does that. He rejects God. And they're going to try to replace him with either, I don't know if it's a Baal or somebody from another. Nobody knows if he's from Syria or if he's just somebody within Jerusalem. Because obviously there's a lot of intrigue going on. If you go... No, you go so quickly from Jotham to Ahaz, and it says that the people are corrupt. What do you think is going on there? You know, we think that our political landscape today is divided and divisive and filled with anger and bitterness. And it is in some ways, and it's something Christians should avoid entirely, especially at least the bitterness of it and the hatred of anybody who just happens to disagree with you. But this is that on steroids. And so there is turmoil within the city. In fact, when Jerusalem, we'll talk about this when we get to the fall of Jerusalem, they're killing each other in Jerusalem. And they do the same thing during the days of Rome, after the crucifixion of Christ. They're killing each other, fighting for control of who's going to be in charge. So that's why Christians have nothing to do with that nonsense. So anyway, they're going to replace him. And so there is an indication of palace intrigue. In fact, look in chapter 8, Isaiah chapter 8. Let me read verses 11 through 13.
"For thus the Lord spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of this people, saying, you are not to say it is a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy, and you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, and he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread.
So there's, I think, a reference to that intrigue and all of that inner back and forth inside the city itself. Does that passage ring any bells with any of you? The New Testament bells? All right, keep your marker there. Flip over to 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3. Somebody read verses 13 through 15.
Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect.
Okay? All right, so that part, the last part of verse 14 is a direct quote. New American Standard says, and do not fear their intimidation. What is it, verse 12? And you are not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. But sanctify Christ as Lord in your hearts. Verse 13, it is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy or sanctified, and he shall be your fear. So Peter's pulling from this text to encourage Christians to not be afraid no matter what goes on in the life, in life around them. Thoughts, problems, comments? Yes, sir.
It just reminds me of what Todd had said in his previous class about the core problem with these kings and with the people was fear. Fear is always what drives us away from God, and that's, yeah, well, he said it better than I did.
Good comments, very good comments. All right, the third thing is here is that in the context, roughed up by ruffians. When you hang out with bad people, you get beat up. And so when he's going to hang out with it, he's going to be disobedient to God. He's going to be punished. And I've got there he is. Loki got woke up a little bit on by the, anybody remember? All right. You know, I'm a movie guy. Anybody remember the scene?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Huh?
It's from Avengers and Hulk beats up Loki.
Yeah. Hulk beat him up, walked away, and said, "Puny God," because he said, "Stop! I am a god." And puny God walked away. All right, so he gets roughed up. Isaiah chapter 7. We talked about that. There's a peak out and peak high. Go back to chapter 1 of Isaiah, chapter 1, verses 4 through 9. And we're not going to have time to read that, but verse 4 says, verse 6 says, from the sole of the foot even to the head, there is nothing sound in it, only bruises, welts, and raw wounds, not pressed out or bandaged, not softened with oil. Your land is desolate, your cities are burned with fire, and they are attacked. 2 Kings 16, verses 5 through 6, these passages here talk about how these two kings came down and did everything except take Jerusalem and capture Ahaz. They killed some of his kids, they killed a bunch of important people, they were just overwhelmed them, defeated an army, took a bunch of people away into captivity, back to Damascus, and then a bunch into to Samaria. In fact, what happened when the Israelites came back with a bunch of captives to Samaria? Over 200,000 of them.
A prophet rebuked them and told them to send them back, and even some of the men of Israel said, "We can't do this."
All right, so a prophet, exactly. Ian, the prophet rebuked them. And some men stood up and said, "He's right, we can't do this." And interestingly enough, the soldiers said, "Okay, turn and walk away." And so these men cleaned up and dressed and fixed those folks up and took them all back down to Jericho so that they could go back and be reunited with their families. So they get beat up. Fourth thing, reliance on a foreign alliance. All right, so he just can't figure out how to defeat them, so he's going to rely on somebody, and I found out who he relied on. How do you think that worked out? Not too good. So this is Thanos from the movies, but who does Thanos represent?
Assyria.
So he's going to go to the biggest, baddest person in the universe and use him against these other two guys. And so that's what it's talked about there. And God, what is God trying to tell him? Don't do that. Trust me. Because in the process of doing that, he has to pay a tribute. He has to plunder the temple, does everything he can to appease him. And even that still doesn't buy him off, because eventually that king is going to come down and try to take him over too. It's not going to be enough to get the tribute. He wants it all. He has a voracious appetite. All right? And the last thing is reduced to bootlicking. Because he's begging, he's pleading, he's doing everything. He sets out, he goes and he sets up an idol, takes an idol that he sees the king of Assyria worship, or an altar, brings it down, and has the king, priest set it up in the temple, move the altar that had been built during the days of Solomon, and has it moved around to the backside so that they can set up this altar, this foreign altar up front, and he's going to worship on it, worship God. It's amazing how they, and so he becomes a bootlicker, and they eventually come in, and you see how that works out. It doesn't end well. It never ends well when you submit to bullies, because they just always want more. All right. Got 4 minutes left. Go very quickly, kind of tie this all together. Yeah, reading, and so Ahaz dies. Actually, how old is it? If you do the math, he's 20 when he becomes king. He dies after reigning for 16 years.
So, mid-30s.
Yeah, he's 35, 36 years old. Just did, you know, just count the years exactly. Remember, their years, counting a little different than the way we do it. But 36 years old. Anybody here younger than that? I know some of you are. Several of you are. Anybody right about that age? I want to ask him if he's older. Anyway. So young guy. He dies. Doesn't say how he died. Doesn't say whether it was illness or whether it was wounds or what. But he's gone. He's done. And they didn't even bury him with the king. They buried him in the city, but not with the king. Now, reading through and trying to pull all this together, I think it was harder even than trying to pull the various timelines together for the meanwhile back at the ranch that we've been doing earlier. In part because of trying to figure out the timeline of Ahaz's actions in Kings, Chronicles, and in Isaiah. But mostly because as you read through this, this is just heartache and suffering and pain and anguish that is so easily preventable. Why was it preventable? What did they have to do? The one simple thing that was too hard for him to do and too hard for many people to do today.
Turn to God.
Turn to God. Trust God. Put their faith in God. It's all unnecessary, but it came about because they would not honor and serve their God. I remember somebody say one time, a very stoic man, said he wouldn't even smile at a box of puppies. And, I mean, who can't smile at a box of puppies? All right? Because it's something that brings joy in his life, and they're just so boisterous, full of life. And the same concept is flipped. Who could not cry? We don't shed tears. And if this doesn't tear in our heart over the sorrow and sadness that is brought by disobedience to God in our own lives, in the lives of our family and friends, and in the lives of our children, why are we even smiling for a box of puppies? You know, it's...
Well, I think we're raising a generation of people who don't like children. They value dogs more than they do a child.
And it's true. That is so very true.
So we're not a whole lot different than...
That's it. Of all the lessons to take from it is exactly what you just said, Andrew. We're not any different. We fight those same battles. We have. That's why I kept saying about restoration is repeat, repeat, repeat. All right, Mitch, just tell us about... All right, Mitch, just bring a box full of puppies on this tonight.
That would be fun.
Huh? I'll do it.
I have a challenge with my friend.
Maybe all the kids want to be in here.
I mean, I'm spending an hour or so in the elder's office, but.
We're still getting those on a Friday.